Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 121. It's Monday, July 5th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, we've passed the Independence Day date, where we had the goal, or Biden had the goal, of having 70% of adults with at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccination. They hit 67%, close, but not quite the goal. Most of the Northeast states seem to have reached it, but most of the rest of the country has fallen short. I bring that up partly just to mention that I think we need to switch the metric to two doses, the full protection. And this is for the protection against the Delta variant and the Delta Plus variant, an even scarier variant that seems to be a new one emerging all the time. And this is part of the problem with having rampant transmission across the world. So in the next few weeks, I'll be switching my reporting from one dose to fully vaccinated for the local, state, and national reporting. Okay, so where do Americans stand as we are in the summer here? Over a year into the pandemic, Gallup poll just came out with some data saying that 3 in 10 Americans think the pandemic is over in the U.S. Of course, the pandemic being over in a singular country is a little bit of a misnomer, but they asked people this. 29% says the pandemic is done. 71% say it is not. 62% say their lives are, quote, somewhat back to normal. And 54% say their lives are not disrupted now. 40% do not expect their lives will ever be normal again. I think that's probably perhaps the most interesting data. I've never been a big fan of normal anyways, so I'm hoping that the 40% who do not expect their lives will ever be normal again represents some resistance to the status quo and are looking for some positive changes to come out emerging from this pandemic. And of course, vaccination is the ultimate way to get out of this pandemic. But this from Medical Express, most Americans who wanted COVID vaccine have already gotten one. In another sign that coronavirus vaccination rates have plateaued in America, a new poll shows that most adults who wanted a COVID-19 vaccine have already gotten one. But only 3% of those who haven't been vaccinated said they plan to do so as soon as they can. About 14% said they will definitely not get vaccinated. Last Tuesday, Dr. Anthony Fauci warned that there could be, quote, two Americas, one where most people are vaccinated and another where low vaccination rates could trigger spikes in cases. Nearly 20% of the people who are not vaccinated said they believe the vaccine is too new. A smaller number of people surveyed cited other reasons, like concerns about side effects or distrust in the government. More than 30% of adults who are not immunized said they would be more inclined to get a vaccine if it's completely approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. All COVID-19 vaccines in the United States are now only approved for emergency use. The report did uncover one bright spot. When employers encourage vaccination, rates rise. About 73% of workers with employers encouraging COVID-19 vaccination said they've received at least one shot, compared to only 41% with employers not encouraging vaccination. Getting more Americans vaccinated isn't only up to the government, the Kaiser Family Foundation president and CEO Drew Altman said in a Kaiser news release. Even without requiring workers to get a vaccine, employers can play a role by offering paid time off to get vaccinated, encouraging their workers to do so. The report also found that in most American households, either everyone is vaccinated against COVID-19 or no one is. The poll shows 77% of vaccinated adults said everyone in their home is vaccinated, while 75% of unvaccinated adults said no one they live with is vaccinated. But overall, more people live in vaccinated houses. 50% of adults said they live in fully vaccinated households, while 25% said they're in fully unvaccinated households, the poll showed. And to drive home Dr. Fauci's concept of two Americas, this from the Washington Post. Craving freedom from virus, U.S. heads into Independence Day with sharply divided risk. More than 2,000 counties representing over half of the American population have not met Biden's goal of 70% of adults receiving at least one dose of the coronavirus vaccine by Independence Day, according to an analysis by the Washington Post. Those counties are seeing steeper increases in new cases and double the rate of tests coming back positive compared with counties who have met the president's goal. New infections are starting to tick up again after a steady decline, with 25 states reporting higher 7-day averages and more cases likely undercounted because of lower testing. As of last Thursday, 18 states reported increases in the 7-day average of hospitalized COVID-19 patients. The CDC Director Rochelle Walensky then urged unvaccinated Americans to wear masks and to practice social distancing. Her agency has identified about 1,000 counties where fewer than 30% of residents are fully vaccinated. Public health officials in some of those areas have resigned themselves to the fact that residents have made up their minds, and some are fine with the risk of contracting the virus. People are not responding to the uptick by going to get vaccinated, said Denise Burley, health director of Mojave County, Arizona, where under a third of residents are fully vaccinated, and about 15% of recent test results are positive, a sign that even more infections are going undetected. What we are seeing is the greatest increase in the 20 to 44 population, and of course many of these people are healthy and feel they don't necessarily need the vaccination because they can contract the virus and get sick and recover, Burley said. There is no real sense of urgency. While at lower risk for severe COVID-19 complications, young adults are far from immune. As of May, nationwide, just under one-third of hospitalized COVID-19 patients were between ages of 18 and 49, the Post found. But preliminary June data showed they make up 43% of hospitalized COVID-19 patients, surging past the share of hospitalized in the age groups 50 to 64 and the over 64 set. Nevada has risen to the top of the list of states with the most per capita new cases and has seen its positivity rate creep above the 5% threshold set by the World Health Organization as a sign of the pandemic coming under control. Clark County, home of Las Vegas, has been driving much of this uptick as its iconic casinos and clubs fully reopen and tourism roars back. The Delta variant made up 46% of the samples reviewed by the Nevada State Public Health Laboratory in the 2 weeks leading up to June 28th, up from 16% in the 2 weeks ending June 18th. A population split among the protected and the unprotected carrying on like normal creates dangerous conditions for the virus's spread, officials said. Well, the more pernicious COVID-19 variants seem to be what's driving this. And we have this from the New Republic. The Delta COVID variant's urgent message for America. Vaccinate, do it quickly. Last week, Israel was with one of the highest COVID-19 vaccination rates in the world, reported something troubling. The so-called Delta variant was driving another COVID-19 spike in the country, and half of the cases were among fully vaccinated people. The Delta variant is what experts have long feared. It's more contagious, bringing a wave of hospitalizations and deaths for unvaccinated people wherever it goes, and it shows the early signs of being able to evade vaccines. In early June, one vaccine scientist dubbed Delta the variant of the future because it signals, far sooner than experts hoped, the rise of more worrying strains. Israel has been a test case of sorts, a window into what happens when the majority of a country is vaccinated quickly and efficiently with one type of vaccine. The question now is what Israel's data on Delta should mean for other countries. And so far, experts are united behind a message that may seem counterintuitive, given Israel's report that vaccinated people are becoming infected. The best approach is still to vaccinate people as quickly as possible. In addition, government should take some basic precautions to prepare for a rise in Delta and other variants. Right now, experts told me, the United States is screwing up. The vaccines we have now remain incredibly good at preventing severe illness and death, even against the Delta variant. People who contracted COVID-19 after vaccination tend to have less of the virus in their bodies with mild or no symptoms and shorter length of illness, recent studies show. And there's another crucial part. Even if they do still get a mild case of COVID, the chance they will pass the virus to someone else will be incredibly low. This is particularly true for those who receive the mRNA vaccines. The vaccine is still your best defense, Dr. Andrea Cox, professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University of Medicine, said. The rise of the Delta variant, therefore, shows us how important it is to fully vaccinate as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, around the world. The more contagious a variant is, the higher the percentage of vaccinations we need to reach community immunity. The rise of such a contagious variant and the promise of others like it to come makes the goal of global vaccination even more pressing. Experts are concerned that SARS-CoV-2 will continue evolving until the vaccines don't prevent illness or death as well as they did, and that unvaccinated people will continue getting sick and dying as the pandemic drags on. This is the toughest version of the virus by far that we've seen, Dr. Eric Topol, director and founder of the Scripps Research Translational Institute, said. Delta is about 40% more contagious than the Alpha variant, or B.1.1.7, which was itself more contagious than the original virus. And although the vast majority of people are strongly protected by vaccines, a recent report from Israel found that the vaccine was about 5% less effective in people above the age of 75 and those with hypertension, diabetes, and obesity. The vaccine was not designed against the Delta variant, and not everyone is responding perfectly to the vaccines. That is a problem, Cox said. However, she added, those who are infected following vaccination are still not getting sick and dying like was happening before vaccination. Although cases among vaccinated people have risen in other countries, hospitalizations and deaths have not risen at the same pace, which shows how effective the vaccines have been at saving lives. We need more data on how well the vaccines prevent transmission of the Delta variant specifically, but research on previous variants is encouraging. The most pressing worry is for those who have not received any vaccines at all. Unvaccinated people account for the vast majority of all COVID-19 cases. There are people out there that have a flashing sign on their forehead saying to Delta, infect me, infect me. Because the virus is going to find these people. It's just so good at that. And I don't think people understand, Topol said. This virus is the most efficient virus for finding new hosts that are vulnerable. Sluggish vaccination rates mean we're definitely going to prolong the pandemic. We've got too many patches of vulnerability. Cases are now rising precipitously among states and regions with low vaccination rates. Nevada, Missouri, Arkansas, Wyoming. Delta is doubling almost every week, now representing about one-third of all COVID cases in the U.S. A lot of people keep talking about the fall, referring to predictions of a possible autumnal spike in cases. But the Delta variant story is going to be played out largely in July and August at the latest. It's all over the country, dominant in the next few weeks. And there's another problem. It's still difficult to understand exactly how prevalent Delta and other emerging variants are, because we're still not doing enough genomic sequencing and surveillance in the U.S., Topol said. The CDC got $1.2 billion from the Rescue Fund to do this, and they've done nothing. They're not even putting out their request for funding application until late August, so we're just sitting on this. In this country, we have only learned about variants by other countries telling us, watch out for this, watch out for that. In particular, the CDC has made the perplexing decision not to track mild or asymptomatic breakthrough cases, the term for illnesses among fully vaccinated people. Topol calls this a travesty. While it can be difficult to capture enough viruses for sequencing if someone has a low viral load, a very good thing for preventing transmission, every breakthrough case can be examined and should be, Topol said, to understand how exactly the virus broke through the vaccine's protective barrier. That's how new variants of concern would be detected, Topol said. If you don't look, you don't find. In addition, he said, full licensure of the vaccines from the FDA could help overcome some hesitations people have about getting a new vaccine. Every shot in an arm helps reduce the chance of spreading this and future variants. An FDA approval would also remove some barriers of institutions seeking to make vaccinations mandatory. If everybody got vaccinated, the virus wouldn't be circulating and wouldn't have the chance to develop these mutations that enhance the efficiency of transmission, Cox said. And if everybody got vaccinated, we would protect the people who don't respond well to the vaccine by forming a shield around them of vaccinated people who will prevent transmission to them. In the face of rising cases, Israel a week ago resumed its indoor mask mandate among the fully vaccinated. Los Angeles County followed suit amid a Delta wave, despite high rates of vaccination and some immunity from surviving previous bouts with the virus. The World Health Organization has also recommended that vaccinated people continue wearing masks, particularly in places with low vaccination rates. Responding to these developments and increasing concern about the Delta variant, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the CDC director, reiterated the agency's position that fully vaccinated people mostly don't need masks, but that local authorities might use masking ordinances to protect the unvaccinated. Mask mandates, like vaccinations, have become highly politicized in the U.S. Those who remain most at risk because they are unvaccinated are also those most likely to shun masks. Instead of mandates, therefore, it's probably more effective to focus on the proven ways we can protect ourselves and others from a virus that is only growing more severe. That means continuing to expand access to vaccines for the people who are hardest to reach and often most at risk, as places like New York City did last week, allowing anyone to request at-home vaccinations. Without a sustained effort to vaccinate the world, it's only a matter of time before the next alarming variant emerges. And, of course, that alarming variant is emerging now. This from the New York Times. In India, concern mounts over a variant called Delta Plus. As India begins to reopen after a devastating second wave of coronavirus infections, concern among virologists is growing that another, possibly more virulent version of the virus could hasten the start of a third wave within just a few months. The version, which has become known locally as Delta Plus, is described by scientists as a sublineage of the highly contagious Delta variant and has spread rapidly through India, Britain, and the United States and other countries. The new variant carries a spike protein mutation that is also found in the Beta variant, first identified in South Africa, though it's unclear how the shared mutation might affect the variant's function. Because of its recent discovery, there have not yet been any studies of this particular variant, so scientists have limited information. They have begun to speculate about its ability to spread, however. It is most likely capable of dodging immunity, said Shahid Jamil, a virologist and director of the Trivedi School of Biosciences at Ashoka University in Sonipat, India. This is because it carries all symptoms of the original Delta variant and also from its partner, Beta variant. And I would add that the Beta variant, the one from that originated in South Africa, actually decimated they stopped using the AstraZeneca because it only had like about a 10% protection. And this is a real crucial thing, both for that one Beta itself, but now that Beta has apparently combined with Delta, you've got increased transmission and increased ability to break through, particularly natural infection. In Brazil, we had the same thing. When the Brazilian variant was cutting through those that were previously infected, which is not as strong of immunity as you get from the vaccinations, they had huge waves and record amounts of cases and deaths. So, folks, now we've got the worst of all the, basically all the variants now in this new Delta Plus. Look out. And to get a taste of what's happening around the world, this from Medical Express. Thai virus surge prompts concerns over ICUs and vaccine supply. Health authorities in Thailand reported over 6,200 new COVID cases on Saturday, setting a record for a third straight day, as concerns mount over shortages of treatment facilities and vaccine supplies. Around 90% of Thailand's over 271,000 reported coronavirus cases and 95% of deaths were recorded during a surge that began in early April. There were 992 deaths in June, more than 15 times Thailand's total for all of 2020. Epidemiologist Kamnuen Ungachosak said that the arrival of the Delta variant of the virus, believed to be more contagious, could push the number of deaths up to 1,400 in July and more in coming months. He said 80% of the deaths are among elderly and people with chronic diseases, and if they are vaccinated, it could significantly reduce the death rate while also lowering the demand for ICU beds. Around 10% of elderly and infirm patients die. Sopan Mekthon, chairman of the government subcommittee on COVID-19 vaccine management, said only 2 million of about 16 million old and infirm people have received vaccines. That's only 1 in 8. And in a more comparable country, that might be a harbinger of things to come in the U.S., this from Reuters. Britain's COVID-19 cases up 53% in past week. Britain has reported 27,000 new cases of COVID-19, government data showed today, meaning the rise in cases between June 29th and July 5th stood at just over 53% compared with the previous 7 days. Well, you've heard it before on this show, and other experts have also pointed out, you can get a harbinger of things to come by looking at other countries. It was Italy at the beginning of the pandemic. It seems to be the UK for us recently. So hopefully we can get our act together and those low vaccination rates can ramp up. Let's do it, people. Get fully vaccinated. And we're getting more and more solid scientific data that vaccinations work very well. This from Medical Express. COVID-19 vaccine reduces severity, length, viral load for those who still manage to get infected. Individuals who contract COVID-19 even after vaccination are likely to have lower viral load, experience a shorter infection time, and have milder symptoms than those who are unvaccinated, according to research that includes data from an ongoing University of Arizona Health Sciences study. Researchers found that study participants who are partially or fully vaccinated with the Pfizer and Moderna messenger RNA vaccines at the time of infection had a viral load that was 40% less than that of unvaccinated participants. In addition to disease severity, researchers looked at longevity of infection. The majority of infections among unvaccinated participants were detected for 2 or more weeks, compared to only 1 week among vaccinated participants. That represents a 66% reduction in the risk that a vaccinated person will have a confirmed infection for more than 1 week. Additionally, the risk of having COVID-19 with an accompanying fever was 58% lower for vaccinated participants, who reported 2 fewer sick days in bed on average, and an overall length of illness that was 6 days shorter than that of unvaccinated people. Okay, well, workers continue to be vaccinated less than non-workers. This from The Hill. Poll: workers more likely to be vaccinated if employers offered paid time off. A recent poll found that American workers are more likely to be vaccinated against COVID-19 if their employers offer paid time off for them to get and recover from the shots, indicating a potential way to boost vaccination rates. The Kaiser Family Foundation Vaccine Monitor for June determined that 75% of workers who employers offered paid time off the shots are vaccinated, compared to 51% of workers at companies that don't give paid time off. Similarly, 73% of workers whose employers encourage vaccination rates have gotten the jab, while 41% of employees at workplaces that don't give this encouragement are vaccinated. The difference in these vaccination rates among workers remain after the Kaiser Family Foundation controlled for age, race and ethnicity, education, income, and party identification. Liz Hamill, the Vice President and Director of Public Opinion and Survey Research at Kaiser Family Foundation, told The Hill that previous polling showed that a large share of people who hadn't got the vaccine were worried about missing work for the shot and any side effects. But the recent results seemed to show employers could have a role in increasing worker vaccination rates. Out of all respondents' employers, half were given paid time off to receive and recover from the vaccine, and 65% have encouraged workers to get vaccinated. Only 9% of workers said their employers mandated vaccines. A majority of workers at 61% said they oppose their own employer requiring vaccinations. Those who are unvaccinated and those who identify as or lean Republican were more likely to be against a mandate from their employer at 92% and 85% respectively. Still, 42% of unvaccinated employees said if their company mandated a vaccine to keep working, they would get it. The administration has steered clear of weighing in on vaccine requirements and passports, saying they would not be implemented at the federal level and the decision will fall on private businesses. Okay, time for the local COVID-19 update. And this will be the shortest ever, I think. Okay, the Lucas County average daily number of cases of the last week has dropped to 7, which is only about half of what it was a few weeks ago. Good news. The testing positivity rates, that is those who go to get tested, how many tests positive, continues to decline. It's at 1.5% in Lucas County and 1.2% in the state. Nursing home cases continue to be low, with repeating again with only 3 cases, none of them residents. All 3 of the cases in Lucas County in the most recent reporting week were 3 staff members. New hospitalizations continue to trend down steadily in both Lucas County and Ohio. More good news. Deaths nationally have cracked under an average of 250 a day, although it's still around 90,000 deaths a year. That's a pace that is way, way, way more than enough to catch the alarms of public health people. For instance, traffic deaths would be like 20, 25,000 a year, something in that order. Okay, vaccines with one dose or more in the U.S., we've reached almost 55%. But there's been a less than a 1% increase over the previous week, and that almost 55% is lagged by just under 48% and 48% for the state and about 47% for Lucas County. And the rate of increase in Ohio and Lucas County is far under even 0.5% an increase, which is only about 0.5% of the rate of vaccination as the U.S. as a whole, which means that Ohio and Lucas County fall further behind from the national average. Okay, well, I want to close our local COVID-19 report with some data that we've got regarding the COVID lottery in Ohio. This from Medical Express. Lottery-based incentives do not increase COVID-19 vaccination rates, says study. Would you be more willing to get a vaccine against the COVID-19 virus if you would participate, if you could participate in a lottery for cash and prizes? The answer was surprisingly no. According to a Boston University School of Medicine, researchers who found that Ohio's Vax-a-Million lottery-based incentive system intended to increase COVID-19 vaccination rates was not associated with an increase in COVID-19 vaccinations. Prior reports in the media had suggested that the Ohio lottery increased COVID-19 vaccinations, leading other states to use COVID-19 vaccine incentive lotteries in an attempt to increase slowing vaccination rates. However, prior evaluations of the Ohio vaccine incentive lottery did not account for other changes in COVID-19 vaccination rates in the United States, such as those that may have been due to expansion of vaccinations at age 12 to 15, which happened at the same time, explained corresponding author Alan Walkey, professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Using data from the CDC to evaluate trends in vaccination rates among adults 18 and older, the researchers compared vaccination rates before and after the Ohio lottery versus other states in the U.S. that did not have a vaccine incentive lottery program. Vaccination rates in other states served as a control for vaccination trends measured in Ohio, allowing the researchers to account for factors besides the Ohio lottery, such as expanding vaccine eligibility for adolescents throughout the country. Our results suggest that state-based lotteries are of limited value in increasing vaccine uptake. Therefore, the resources devoted to vaccine lotteries may be more successfully invested in programs that target underlying reasons for vaccine hesitancy and low vaccine uptake, said Walkey, a physician at Boston Medical Center. The researchers believe identifying interventions that can successfully increase COVID-19 vaccination rates is a critical public health issue necessary to curb the pandemic. It is important to rigorously evaluate strategies designed to increase vaccine uptake, rapidly deploy successful strategies, and phase out those that do not work. Although Walkey and his colleagues were sorry to see that state lottery incentives were not associated with an increase in COVID-19 vaccinations, they hope their findings will lead to a shift in focus away from ineffective and expensive lotteries and on to further study of other programs that may more successfully increase vaccine uptake. Okay, folks, well, this is one reason why we do evaluations, to find out what works. And surprise, surprise, interesting novelties don't always pan out as working. Okay, well, Ohio's $5 billion lottery is actually kind of a blip on the screen. One of the long-term pandemic-long divides in this country and many places around the world has been between the false choice between public health interventions and economic success. And now we have some new data. This from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. States with more stringent COVID rules had both better economic and health outcomes, data shows. In April 2020, with the pandemic in full swing, The Economist published, quote, "A grim calculus. COVID-19 presents stark choices between life, death, and the economy." Soon, Americans were blaming the lockdowns for a recession. And in the words of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, quote, "The destructions of millions of lives across America without any corresponding benefit of COVID mortality." Before the end of the year, some states, notably Texas, were ending COVID restrictions with the goal of improving their economic activity. Now that 2020 is mercifully in the past, we have data from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis to evaluate the, quote, "grim calculus" in each state. And looking at that data, especially for large states, which have more diversified economies, the results may surprise. It's hard to find any real trade-off between COVID lockdowns and decreased economic activity. If anything, we found the opposite. Is this just a statistical anomaly? The answer seems to be no. One reason to be confident of the result is to look at other countries. Consider, for example, Sweden, well known for having few stringent COVID-19 measures. In 2020, Sweden had worse health outcomes than the similar Scandinavian countries of Denmark, Norway, and Finland. At the same time, its economic outcomes during the pandemic were no better than any of its healthier neighbors. The finding also fits with history. A 2008 Federal Bank Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis survey of the 1918 influenza pandemic found that St. Louis, which took the flu more seriously and opened up later, had better economic and health outcomes than Philadelphia, a city that opened up sooner. Similarly, 2020 research into the 1918 pandemic found that cities with more stringent interventions had better employment gains and better health outcomes. What explains this seemingly strange but persistent result? The power of government signaling. When a state indicates through policy and pronouncements that it takes the pandemic seriously enough to impose measures, sometimes extreme, to control the spread of the disease and protect public health, it is sending a message to its citizens. Part of that message is about businesses. The state is saying that there are protocols in place to make open businesses as safe as possible, and were that not possible, the businesses would be closed. But when a state indicates through policy, as Sweden did, that individuals should make a choice as to what they do during a pandemic and that the government will not choose for them, it sends a different signal. It is saying, citizens, you are on your own. Choose wisely. Wisely. Wisely as well. So while an open business will be busier than a closed one, the open businesses are likely to do better in a place with more stringent restrictions. The bottom line is that people respond to the information they have and the signals they receive from their government. Clearly, business closures increase unemployment in affected sectors, but there's no evidence suggests that closures and other public health interventions have led to worse economic outcomes overall. So the trade-off, such as it is, must be between sectors directly affected by interventions and, in states and countries with fewer interventions, voluntary lower demand and more work absenteeism due to higher overall infection rates. Knowing all this, you might still believe that the freedom to choose is valuable enough to pay the societal and health costs of that freedom, but empirically, it is not a trade-off between health and economic outcomes. It is a trade-off between the freedom to choose and public health. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, in more news on the gap between established public health practice and what actually happens in the real world, this from Medical Express. Only 20 states use health equity committees in COVID-19 vaccine distribution planning. In a new study published in JAMA Network Open, while 43 states out of 51, including all 50 states in Washington, D.C., created a committee to develop a vaccine distribution plan, only 20 of those plans mentioned using a health equity committee to assist with plan development. Of those 20 health equity committees, only 8 actually included minority group representation, with remaining members including physicians, government officials, ethicists, and clergy. Yeah, I was even a little surprised by this. I complained a lot about the fact that that equity issues were not being addressed well, and because we had this patchwork of states, this just drives that home. And it reminds me of that quote, "If you're not at the table, you are on the menu." Public health folks have known for a long time that it's best to listen to those people that are most affected. To drive that point home, this from Medical Express. Want to help fight for health justice? It may be time to listen. A pandemic, protests, and politics have highlighted the nation's long-standing, deep-seated racial issues and how they affect the health of millions of Americans. People who've never confronted racism before are asking, how can I show them an ally? For the uninitiated, being a partner in a fight against racism can begin by looking inward. First and foremost, it's about listening, particularly listening to communities and the people that are directly impacted by injustices, said Judy Lubin, president of the Center for Urban and Racial Equity, a social change consulting group in Washington, D.C. Before anybody who's part of a privileged majority rushes in, they need to understand where they fit in, Lubin and others say. Discussions about racial disparities aren't new, but COVID-19, which has disproportionately affected Black, Hispanic, American Indian, and Asian communities, has helped move the conversation about race and health to the medical profession's highest levels. Top medical journals have run columns. Well-established groups such as the AMA and the American Heart Association have denounced structural racism. Research continues to show the connection between the deep roots of racism and health inequities. For example, while overall death rates from heart disease and stroke declined over the past two decades until a recent plateau, these gains were not equitably shared among people who are from the Black, Asian, American Indian, and Hispanic or Latino communities. Black adults experience a 30% higher death rate from heart disease and a 70% higher death rate from stroke compared with their white peers, according to the latest CDC data from 2018. After a cardiac arrest, Black and Hispanic patients experience significantly lower survival to hospital discharge than white patients, even when controlling for socioeconomic status. Researchers have linked such health problems to a web of factors that have structural racism at their base. Focusing on health and racism is good, said Lubin, who have both had masters in public health and a doctorate in sociology. But sometimes, on an individual level, people who say they're allies go out of their way to put the focus on themselves. It becomes a performance, she said, sometimes fueled by social media. The term allyship is often used in discussions and guides about supporting the need for change. But Lubin said many people addressing racial inequity are focusing more on the idea of solidarity, which involves making space and listening to and respecting the leadership of people of color. That type of listening, said Lubin, is often a challenge for white people, particularly those in leadership positions who think it's their job to be the first person to offer ideas. In contrast, she sees solidarity as making space so affected people can speak for themselves. Dr. Harlan Krumholz agrees. He's director of the Yale New Haven Hospital Center for Outcomes Research and Evaluation. It's important for those of us who are outside of those groups that are directly affected are standing up and speaking loudly, he said. But we need to be sure that the attention stays firmly on those who are suffering. Over his career, Krumholz has led programs to illuminate health disparities and promote greater diversity in the profession. He's spoken about the need to partner with affected communities on such issues. People have to be willing to take on problems that might not affect them directly, he said, because what happens to people who come from a different background, defined by race, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, or more, reflects on us, our healthcare system, and our society. And it affects us too. I may not be Black, but I've got to talk about the implications of being Black in this society, he said. There are people who are experiencing the structural racism, who know it, for whom it is deeply personal, and they can see it with clear eyes. Everyone else is then obligated to listen and learn, Krumholz said, and not draw attention to ourselves for just doing what is right. The focus must be on those who are disadvantaged and repairing a society that has caused this situation. An ally's job, he said, involves helping those without voice gain voice and stand up against the injustices within healthcare and within society to try to promote a better society, one in which everybody has a fair shot to be healthy and a fair shot at a good life. That's an attitude Lubin encourages when people ask how to be allies. Solidarity, she said, is about doing things that honor the dignity of everyone, which does not make it simple. There's no checklist on how to be in solidarity, although there are lots of articles and resources out there, she said. Her organization lists several. Universities from Georgia to Georgetown and beyond have pages devoted to allyship. The Seattle Public Library offers an extensive reading list. And if solidarity starts with listening and learning, eventually it demands more. A white person who understands how systemic racism has kept people of color out of leadership roles might realize they need to step aside to create room for someone, Lubin said. It also involves risk, whether confronting family members or putting a job on the line with a problematic employer. At the end of the day, action is what's important, she said. But we also don't want action that's harmful, and that's why it's so critical that self-reflection and awareness is happening. supporting the humanity and dignity of groups who haven't historically had privileges ends up lifting all of society, she says. When systems work for the most marginalized, they end up working better for everyone. Okay, well, as we get back to the oft-dreaded so-called normal, this from The Intercept. Whistleblowers expose corruption in EPA Chemical Safety Office. Managers and career staff in the EPA's Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention tampered with the assessment of dozens of chemicals to make them appear safer, according to four scientists who work at the agency. The whistleblowers, whose jobs involve identifying the potential harms posed by new chemicals, provided The Intercept with detailed evidence of pressure within the agency to minimize or remove evidence of potential adverse effects of the chemicals, including neurological effects, birth defects, and cancer. On several occasions, information about hazards was deleted from agency assessments without informing or seeking the consent of the scientists who authored them. Some of these cases led the EPA to withhold critical information from the public about potentially dangerous chemical exposures. In other cases, the removal of the hazard information or altering of the scientists' conclusions and reports paved the way for the use of chemicals, which otherwise would not have been allowed on the market. This is the first of a series of articles based on the four whistleblowers' highly detailed allegations, which were supported by dozens of internet emails with supervisors, meeting summaries, and other documents. Together, the evidence they provided showed a pattern in which the EPA failed to follow the law that oversees chemical regulation, particularly the Toxic Substances Control Act, and depicts a workplace in which EPA staffers regularly face retribution for following the science. The Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention is broken, the scientists wrote in a statement they provided to The Intercept and Representative Ro Khanna of California, chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform. The entire new chemicals program operates under an atmosphere of fear. Scientists are afraid of retaliation for trying to implement the Toxic Substances Control Act the way Congress intended, and they fear that their actions or inactions at the direction of management are resulting in harm to human health and the environment. The four EPA staff members who hold doctorates in toxicology, chemistry, biochemistry, and medicinal chemistry said that they told colleagues and supervisors within the agency about the interference with their work. Each of the scientists also filed complaints with either the EPA's Inspector General or the Office of Scientific Integrity, which has pledged to investigate corruption within the agency. But because most of their concerns remained unaddressed months after they disclosed them, and because in each case, the altering of the record presented a potential risk to human health, the scientists said they felt compelled to make their complaints public. Okay, well, this is just a short excerpt of a very long article, and it's the first in a series of four that The Intercept is doing. So I have posted this online. You can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT, and you can see the link to this and other articles.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, in somewhat better news and getting accountability, this from Stat News. Johnson & Johnson agrees to pay $230 million to settle opioid case in New York. On the eve of a widely anticipated trial, Johnson & Johnson agreed last week to pay $230 million to the state of New York to settle a lawsuit alleging that the company helped fuel the devastating opioid crisis. The agreement comes after states, cities, and counties around the U.S. filed more than 3,000 lawsuits against pharmaceutical manufacturers and distributors over the opioid crisis, which has claimed nearly 500,000 people over the past two decades. Numerous drug makers have been accused of downplaying the addictive risks of their opioid painkillers while simultaneously encouraging physicians to overprescribe the medicines. As a result, some patients became addicted and abused still other illegal forms of opioids. Over the same time, state and local governments allege that wholesalers failed to sufficiently monitor suspicious shipments. The opioid epidemic has wreaked havoc on countless communities across New York State and the rest of the nation, leaving millions still addicted to dangerous and deadly opioids. Johnson & Johnson helped fuel this fire, but today they're committing to leaving the opioid business, not only in New York, but across the entire country. Our trial against the remaining defendants will commence this week, where we will lay bare the callous and deadly pattern of misconduct these companies perpetrated as they dealt dangerous and addictive opioids across our state. As always, our goal remains getting funds to those devastated by opioids as quickly as possible. Okay, well, that's a story largely about the past. This one's more about the future. This from Stat News. Will Biogen's new Alzheimer's drug burden on Medicare be big, huge, or catastrophic? Gotta love those choices. Analysts at the nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation estimated Aduhelm could cost the Medicare program $29 billion per year if 500,000 Medicare patients take the drug. If uptake is at the highest end of Biogen's target population at 2 million, the Medicare cost could be more than $100 billion per year. As the New York Times noted, even the smaller of these two estimates is more than the government currently spends on staffing the entire Centers for Disease Control or NASA. If all 5.8 million Medicare-eligible adults with Alzheimer's took the drug, it would cost $335 billion, or nearly half the budget of the entire Defense Department, which was $704 billion this year. Put differently, $335 billion would buy the government more than 4 million Tesla Model Xs. Aduhelm's price and volume will likely make it the number one expenditure drug in hospitals and clinics over the next 2 or 3 years, according to Eric Tichy, the vice chair of pharmacy formulary at the Mayo Clinic Health System. Okay, well, I've covered a lot on this Aduhelm, this new Alzheimer's drug, and I'm going to make a prediction. I actually think that it's going to be in the lower end of this. Because, first of all, a lot of clinicians are really rejecting the fact that this drug even works. But also, it's very difficult. It medicalizes people's lives. They have to go to an infusion center every month. This, of course, is super expensive. You have to get all kinds of diagnostics. You need to get all kinds of ongoing monitoring lab tests. And worst of all, it has a high rate of very severe complications. So this is very daunting, and anybody who educates themselves about this drug should probably rightfully be a little bit scared or a little bit wary. So I'm predicting that actually this doesn't pan out to be on the worst case scenario, but either way, I think this is the worst decision that FDA has probably made in decades, if not my lifetime. Okay, well, a little bit better news, this from The Hill. 120,000 people in Oklahoma gain Medicaid coverage as expansion takes effect. About 120,000 people in Oklahoma gain Medicaid coverage effective last Thursday as the state expansion of Medicaid takes effect, according to the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. Oklahoma voters passed Medicaid expansion last year on a ballot measure. Oklahoma is now the 37th state to expand the program under the Affordable Care Act. Since applications opened on June 1st, more than 120,000 people have applied for and been determined eligible for Medicaid coverage. An additional 70,000 people who have not yet applied are also eligible, the department said. Today is a victory for the nearly 200,000 Oklahomans who have been waiting for health care, said Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra. I want to congratulate Oklahoma in joining the ranks of states that are bringing quality health coverage to our neighbors and families. I encourage the remaining 13 states to look at the opportunities included in the American Rescue Plan and join us so that every person eligible can get covered. The American Rescue Plan, passed earlier this year, provides an additional 5 percentage points of the federal share of Medicaid funding for a state as an incentive to expand. However, the remaining Republican-controlled holdout states have largely not shown interest in that incentive and are still opposed to expansion. Democrats in Congress are now engaged in discussions about a federal program to provide coverage in the holdout states.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north, at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, I'd like to take a step back and take a historical perspective on Florence Nightingale, who is a groundbreaker and had a lot of contributions to public health. So this from Stat News, Florence Nightingale in the Age of COVID-19. Last May marked the 200th anniversary of the birth of Florence Nightingale. That her bicentennial fell during a worldwide pandemic is both illuminating and ironic. Nightingale's experience as a nurse during the Crimean War in the mid-1850s led her to three insights that came to define her professional life, insights as revolutionary as they were unpopular. Medical care has the potential to do harm. Nurses require stringent and scientific training. Medical care does not exist in a vacuum from the world around it. Nightingale is best known for her work illustrating the first two tenets. When she arrived at the British military hospital in the Scutari region of the Ottoman Empire in November 1854, a year after the war had begun, she was horrified to learn that far more soldiers were dying of infection and poor medical care than were dying on the battlefield. Her rigorous reforms of the wretched medical conditions, reforms which rankled the military higher-ups, slashed the hospital mortality rate from 33% to 2% over the course of a single year. Nightingale's approach to nursing education was equally meticulous, professionalizing a field whose standards until then had ranged from uneven to abysmal. The nursing higher-ups at the time were similarly irritated by her ruffling of the status quo. The third tenet of Nightingale's life's work, that medical care does not exist in a vacuum from the world around it, has received less historical attention. After the Crimean War, Nightingale turned her attention to the health of the British military in India, this time from her London home. The scope of death and suffering dwarfed what was transpiring in Scutari, and these soldiers weren't even fighting a war. While the British public muttered disdainfully about India's miasmas, Nightingale focused instead on data documenting sanitation drainage, water quality, housing construction, food quality, alcohol use, and physical activity. Extending her observations to the civilian population of India, she recognized the need to target education, housing, and the legal system, things we now call social determinants of health. Though Nightingale never budged an inch from her insistence on scrupulously trained nurses as the backbone of good medical care, she knew that this could never be enough. The conditions that people lived in were equally important, if not more so, for achieving the best medical outcomes. As COVID-19 begins to recede in the U.S., Nightingale's observations could hardly be more prescient. The staggeringly uneven toll of infection and death we have witnessed is a bitter confirmation of the interrelationship between healthcare and society. The reason for the disparity are in plain sight: unequal distribution of economic and housing stability, jobs without sick leave or options for telecommuting, crowded homes that render social distancing elusive, long commutes to jobs and grocery stores that preclude sheltering in place, and heavier burdens of chronic disease that contribute to more severe outcomes with COVID. There has been much talk about how to re-envision the healthcare system once we've achieved the much-coveted settling of the dust. There's no doubt that the U.S. healthcare system needs to be more flexible and nimble in nearly every aspect: medical care, public health, research, supplies, prevention, communication, vaccination. The list goes on. But even at our creative best, the medical disparities will remain entrenched unless society is re-envisioned as well. Medical care does not exist in a vacuum from the world around it. Contagious illnesses like COVID-19 bring into stark relief the fact that health is both a communal good and a community effort. Outbreaks can neither be created by individuals or tamed by them. It takes the oft-quoted village. On the one hand, such interdependence goes against the grain of the rugged individualism supposedly embedded in the American DNA. On the other hand, Americans exhibit a strain of community engagement that's especially prominent on the neighborhood and local level. Witness the strength of PTAs, dog runs, community bulletin boards, sports leagues, houses of worship, neighborhood watches, and local libraries. These institutions exemplify the ethos of public health. How we inhabit our shared community has far-reaching effects on everyone's health. Florence Nightingale's efforts presaged the challenges that face us today. Even though her, quote, day job was as a nurse, she recognized that her mandate, by necessity, extended to educating the public and lobbying the government at all levels. She cannily delivered her book, Notes on Hospitals, directly to Queen Victoria. Like outspoken healthcare workers today, she was often told to stay in her lane. Luckily for the untold number of people who lived longer because of her efforts, she did not. Perhaps the most apt metaphor for the COVID experience is the burning house. Everyone in the neighborhood has a vested interest in getting the fire controlled. Moreover, everyone has a vested interest in understanding why the house caught fire to begin with. What were the conditions that made it vulnerable? How can we build houses to make fires less likely? How can we structure the fire department to respond more effectively? Remaking healthcare will mean focusing on the lanes that relate to educational quality, job security, housing stability, and paid sick leave, to name a few. In addition to the more traditional medical lanes like expanding primary care, enhancing mental health and addiction treatment, improving care coordination, controlling drug prices, detoxifying electronic medical records, improving patient safety, and achieving universal, equitable access to healthcare. Florence Nightingale was a boots-on-the-ground clinician as well as a hands-on administrator. She worked in Scutari under grueling circumstances, up to her neck in infectious diseases, much as healthcare workers have been doing during the coronavirus pandemic. These feats of heroism, regretfully, aren't enough, then or now. Improving health for all citizens will indeed require major reconfiguring of the U.S. healthcare system, but we'll only see success if we simultaneously tackle the societal conditions that foster unequal health. Okay, well, talking about health, not living in a vacuum from the world around it, I want to close with this last story from Civil Eats. The food system's carbon footprint has been vastly underestimated. A new analysis pins one-third of global greenhouse gases on the food system by including long-overlooked factors such as transportation, packaging, and waste. A paper recently published in Environmental Research Letters found the global food system was responsible for 16 billion metric tons of greenhouse gas emission in 2018, or a third of all global emissions that year. This is a sharp contrast to the more narrowly defined agriculture sector of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. The categories for greenhouse gas inventories, which accounted for 5.3 billion metric tons in 2018, or just a tenth of the total, according to the IPCC. To be clear, this analysis doesn't add to the total global greenhouse gas emission. Rather, it simply collects all the food-related emissions in one place in an attempt to accurately illustrate the true size of food's carbon footprint. And it reinforces a 2020 research paper that found avoiding catastrophic climate change will be impossible without radically cutting emissions from the global food sector. The new analysis accounts for those emissions that the IPCC allocates to non-agricultural categories, including carbon dioxide from pre-production, like manufacturing fertilizer and farm equipment, and post-production emissions such as food waste disposal, refrigeration, packaging, and transportation. It also includes, as food-related emissions, the conversion of natural ecosystems to agricultural land, which is at nearly 3 billion metric tons per year, are the single largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in their analysis. So again, to accent that last point, the change in our physical environment of going from a natural ecosystem to this monoculturing of agriculture, which is largely what our agricultural is, that right there accounts for 3 of the 16 billion metric tons and is the single largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the food sector. We need to change the way that we farm and get our... Okay, well, lastly, I have half a dozen bonus articles for you this week, which you can read online, and I'll give you the link at the end. First up, frontline healthcare workers aren't feeling the summer of joy. Doctors and nurses are reeling from new COVID cases, staff burnout, and the prolonged stress of dealing with the pandemic. Two, the healthcare workforce is understaffed for life after COVID-19. Three, hospital prices must now be transparent. For many consumers, they're still anyone's guess. Four, cell phone radiation is harmful, but few want to believe it, says researcher. 5. Public health approach to public reform gaining momentum. States, cities redirecting police funding. And lastly, but not leastly, 6, medical sociologist details the failure of American psychiatry. If you're interested in mental health, this is a must read. And you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That is toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.